I am reminded of the words of Jesus, who was both an immigrant and refugee himself. When asked, "Rabbi, what is the greatest commandment of all?" he answered, "Love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself."
This country has been engaged in a massive experiment to see if the masses of people, working class people and poor people, can survive without strong unions, a strong left-wing and radical movement, and a strong militant black liberation movement.
I am a black woman, tall as a cypress, strong beyond all definition still, defying place and time and circumstance, assailed, impervious, indestructible. Look on me and be renewed.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Evarum, and as always, we have a lot packed into our little hour. Today, we are continuing to recognize Women's History Month by honoring author and activist Marie Evans, who joined the Ancestors this month at the age of 97. Fellow poets of the 1960s Black Arts Movement, Sonia Sanchez and Haki Madhubuti, were among the hundreds who gathered in Indianapolis for her funeral on Monday. We'll also hear from Willa Mae Taylor Richmond, who was only 13 years old when she became a foot soldier in the historic 1965 March for Voting Rights, which became known as Bloody Sunday, when peaceful protesters in Selma, Alabama, were viciously attacked by the police. All that is coming up in the second half of the show, and I'll be speaking with author and activist Gerald Horn later, but first some headlines. This week, D.C. became the latest municipality to consider divesting from Wells Fargo Bank. Because of Wells Fargo's investment in the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline, discriminatory and predatory lending practices, and because of other investments that hurt the planet and people, such as the private prison industry. Several council members joined David Grasso in introducing a resolution that would recommend that D.C. reassess its relationship with Wells Fargo and consider more equitable means of managing the city's money. D.C.'s current contract with Wells Fargo includes a $2 billion investment portfolio and an agreement for cash and treasury management services. This is Councilman Grasso.
The District of Columbia has long sought to protect the city's interests and public's trust by managing and spending city funds in a fiscally responsible and prudent manner. As Wells Fargo is the District of Columbia's bank of record, I believe we have an obligation to fully assess our relationship with Wells Fargo and strongly consider divestment. We should prioritize partnerships with business entities and financial institutions that are committed to engaging in fair and responsible business practices, and we should fully commit to reinvesting in local banks to support our community growth.
DC Reinvest is the coalition of DC area grassroots groups behind the Wells Fargo divestment campaign. On the Ground spoke to them after introduction of the resolution.
I'm Sebi Medina Tayak from the Piscataway Nation. We're the local tribal nation for this area. And I went out to Standing Rock, and it really changed my life, and I saw that the front lines of colonialism are present and here right now. So I really was inspired to follow in the footsteps of my family and my community and continue the struggle here as best I could using the resources I had on the local level.
Mm-hmm. And so what's going to happen now?
Okay, so Grasso introduced the bill formally. There are quite a few co-sponsors of the bill, and it's moving now to the Finance Committee. So it's moving forward through the legislative procedures that it needs to actually become a law or a policy. I have a lot of faith that it will. I just think it was really important that they brought up all the intersecting ways that the institution Wells Fargo colonizes and oppresses people in this country and worldwide, because the struggle of black folks, poor folks, Latino folks in these cities, dealing with the predatory and deceitful financial practices of this institution, really parallels them funding projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline and other practices that harm people of color. It's really all part of one system that is important for us to recognize. And as we look around in this movement, we see Black Lives Matter over here standing with us and fighting for us too. And we're fighting for them because our disenfranchisement happens together. We're oppressed together so we can fight together.
Another national issue of sanctuary for undocumented immigrants was also in the news in D.C. this week as dozens of congregations in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia launched DMV Sanctuary to provide support and solidarity for people who are being detained, deported, or profiled. Community and religious leaders from churches, synagogues, mosques, temples rallied on the steps of the Foundry United Methodist Church in Northwest D.C. before marching to the White House.
Good morning. My name is C.J. Rodriguez, and I'm a pastor, minister of the gospel with the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ here in Washington, D.C. This morning we come together as Christians and Jews, Muslims and Buddhists, humanists and those who simply consider themselves spiritual. But above all, we come to this place as people of faith and conscience. We come seeking to ensure that all persons are treated with the human dignity that they deserve, that all people are loved for who they are and just as they are. Our faith and conscience that propels and brings us together to seek the fair and just treatment, not just for some, but for all, no matter who they are, where they come from, or how they got here. We are committed to the long-standing practice of sanctuary used in response to the unjust laws and practices of the government. This is not a matter of partisan politics, my friends, but rather of the collective morality and love that we share for our neighbors, all of our neighbors. A love that surpasses political and religious ideologies. A love that is found in all of our faith traditions. As a Christian, I am reminded of the words of Jesus, who was both an immigrant and refugee himself. When asked, "Rabbi, what is the greatest commandment of all?" he answered, "Love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself." It is in this love of neighbor that we stand with our brothers and sisters today, those who face the threat of deportation and other repressive actions by this current administration. As communities of faith, we are committed to provide sanctuary, sanctuary that began as an interfaith movement of six congregations in 1984 and grew to over 500. Today, this very gathering proves that the movement continues to stand strong. It is a movement that chooses to build bridges of love and hope rather than walls of hate and division. And although the first step of this network is to stand in solidarity with immigrants under threat, this is a practice that can and should be used to create safe, protected, and loving spaces for all people who are targeted, all those who are marginalized and oppressed in and by our society. The Apostle Paul in the Second Testament of the Christian Scripture tells the Galatians that there is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female. For you, we are all one. It is because we are all one in this shared effort that we are here today. And it is for this very reason that we must and will continue to fight for justice and equality for our fellow sisters and brothers, both here and around the world. And my friends, we will not rest. We will not rest today. We will not rest tomorrow. We will not rest until true justice rolls down like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. And so it is. Thank you, and God bless.
Good afternoon. My name is William H. Lamar IV, pastor of Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church here in Washington, D.C. And I stand not only with the other congregations here, persons of faith and of conscience, but I stand on behalf of my ancestors, spiritual geniuses in this cruel space known as America, who sang a song that they taught us, that we sing and teach to our children, And one of those verses says, I'm going to treat everybody right until I die. Amen. For people who were not treated right and whose progeny have not been treated right, we still sing, we will treat everybody right until we die, because our God is the God of all people. And people have asked, why do you stand with these people? Because black bodies have been assaulted since we first came to this space.
That's right.
And they are continuously assaulted. And what we know is, if we are silent when brown bodies are assaulted, when gay bodies are assaulted, when trans bodies are assaulted, when female bodies are assaulted, then all of us remain imprisoned and in bondage. Yes. And so we stand with our brothers and our sisters, because we know, and I want you all to know, black, white, gay, or straight, first them, then you, then me. And those who stand in alliance with those who fight for justice become as vulnerable as those originally victimized by the power structures. And so today we stand as a sanctuary congregation, and we will be offering, along with our colleagues, Know Your Rights trainings, rapid response events to make sure that when persons are raided, we will be there to support them, accompanying people when ICE has checked them in, making sure that congregations are hosting families that may be at risk of deportation, and expanding sanctuary to not just be about solidarity with immigrants, but also solidarity with other targeted persons, including African Americans and the other profiled people, including our Muslim brothers and sisters. We indeed will treat everybody right, and we will remind America that this is a space where certain bodies have always been devalued.
Well.
But together, if we stand, and if we refuse, and if we will not relent, we will send a message to all parties, Republican, Democrat, Independent, that there are persons in this nation, persons of faith and conscience, who believe and who know that all bodies should be valued equally, and if they do not, they will not cease to hear from each of us. God bless you.
In addition to providing sanctuary, religious leaders with DMV Sanctuary said that they are providing other kinds of support to undocumented immigrants, including accompanying them to check-ins with immigration officials. And finally, activists in D.C. fighting to preserve the historic McMillan Park, an open green space in the nation's capital, addressed the district's zoning commission Thursday night. Chantel James has more.
With the integrity of their community under threat, more than 30 citizens of Ward 5 sat before the D.C. Zoning Commission to give testimony to the value of McMillan Park in its natural state. D.C. had met just 2 days earlier over its controversial plans to develop the park into a shopping center, which would bring more than 30,000 more cars and the harmful pollution that accompanied them. Citizens will have further opportunity to testify before the Zoning Commission on April 6th. Until then, the city seems poised to proceed. Naima Jefferson, a Ward 5 resident whose husband and son both experienced health difficulties, took issue with the city's reporting around the subject of McMillan.
We spend a lot of time around the Washington Hospital Center, and I'm really concerned about the report and the transparency, or lack thereof, that exists. Specifically, when I read the report from DDOE, it was erroneous and contained multiple omissions and was seriously flawed.
From Judiciary Square, this is Chantal James signing off.
And those are our headlines and happenings for today. When we come back, author and activist Gerald Horn joins us. Stay with us. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Ivarum, and now it's time to explore more of the policies and decisions coming from Capitol Hill and the White House this week. Here to help us unpack it all is our favorite geopolitical analyst, author, and activist, Professor Gerald Horn. He's a frequent contributor across the Pacifica Network. Welcome back to the show, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, watching the news this week, I can't help but think that the real issues of disastrous budget cuts to vital human needs is the real story not being covered, while corporate media is either focused on what they keep calling Russia hacking, or the other end of the corporate media is now trying to blame the Obama administration for spying on Trump. So, kind of wading through all that madness, what's your take on what's happening here in D.C.?
Well, my take on what's happening in D.C. is a reflection of my take on what's happening across the country. And that is to say that for at least 70, 75 years, this country has been engaged in a massive experiment to see if the masses of people, working class people and poor people, can survive without strong unions, a strong left-wing and radical movement, and a strong militant black liberation movement. And I think that the answer is it cannot survive without those sorts of movements. As we speak, the Republican majority on Capitol Hill are in the midst of their first step towards turning back the clock. That is to say, worsening an already debilitated healthcare system by wrecking Medicaid so that tax cuts can be further given to the wealthiest 1%. This is just the first step in what is going to be a terrible series of steps that's going to inflict massive pain upon poor and working class people, and particularly black people.
And I think the frustrating thing for me is that I don't see this disaster unfolding actually being covered. I'm seeing the kind of jockeying of electoral politics still playing itself out. I see just the kind of inside baseball, inner beltway politics bearing itself out, but no real coverage about what's happening. I even heard the report that they want to take out maternity care out of Medicaid so that women, I suppose, who are pregnant and who are expecting cannot use their Medicaid benefits to have a healthy child. So these things are being debated in a real removed way, away from human needs, and it's very frustrating to me. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is I keep getting a lot of response to a major speech I played on this show last week by Chris Hedges on the rise of Trump and American fascism. And in the news this week is the murder of a black man by a white supremacist in New York City. The failure of a jury or the prosecutors in Portland, Oregon, to indict in another police murder of a black teenager in that city. And then here in D.C., this month marks the six-month anniversary of a young black man, Terrence Sterling, being shot to death by D.C. police. And there's been no movement in terms of an indictment. And the last time this happened, a whole year went by before prosecutors came back with also exonerating the police. So there's a lot of tension still about these extrajudicial killings happening around the country. And not only no response from the police, but now Jeff Sessions saying that he's going to pull back on even the little bit of oversight that the DOJ was giving to the police.
Well, first of all, the first point that you mentioned, the young Euro-American man from Baltimore who traveled all the way to New York to engage in a reign of terror against black men by his own admission, killing at least one with a sword, saying that he came to New York because he wanted to get maximum media attention. This is just one more data point that helps to shed light on the fact that since Donald J. Trump has ascended to the White House, there has been a reign of terror inflicted, not only in terms of that case I've just mentioned, but also in terms of the attacks on Jewish cemeteries. And also reflective of this very disturbing and troubling trend is the statement by Congressman Steve King of Iowa, who said that this culture, so-called, and the civilization, so-called, cannot be built with, quote, somebody else's babies, unquote. In other words, he is anti-choice and anti-white women's reproductive freedom because he thinks they should have more babies. He's disturbed by the fact that other babies are being born, which is genocidal in impulse, and obviously quite troubling, And that incident, too, did not receive the sort of attention, negative attention, that it so richly deserved.
Yes, and I saw coverage on Counterspin, a media show that comes out of New York, pointing out the fact that the NYPD, in giving their reports to the media, in typical fashion in a lot of these cases, was actually talking about the criminal record of the man who was killed. Apparently, he had some crime in his background, but really put that out there first, as opposed to talking about this white supremacist who went to New York to kill him. And I was also looking at coverage of the case where the NYPD is giving their press conference about it. And it was very curious. I mean, I don't know if I'm just from having lived in New York, I'm just so conscious of the racism within the NYPD, but they kept saying that this person came to New York to kill that he was obsessed with killing male blacks. And so this term kept being used in the press conference, male blacks. He didn't say black men or black people, but as if blacks are kind of like a different species than people or human beings. And I was really struck by that. And I don't think that I'm the only one who will hear that in that certain way coming from the NYPD in particular. In other cases, people are very concerned here about the case of the young black girl, teenager, who was gang raped by some other boys or young men, and it was broadcast live on Facebook. And there's also concern, there was actually a big meeting here in this week, like, you know, hundreds of people came because there are cases of black girls and young women missing, and that these cases are increasing. So I don't know if you had some thoughts on that and what's happening where you are in terms of people getting active about it.
Well, I am familiar with the story that suggests that there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of black women that are missing. And what's even more disturbing and troubling, perhaps, is the lack and dearth of attention to the story, particularly in this country when we know the JonBenet case of a few years ago when a young blonde girl is missing or attacked, that gets maximum attention on cable news, a 24-hour news cycle, and yet you have these thousands upon thousands of black younger women, for the most part, missing, and it's like a non-story. And once again, this is just one more data point that tells you and tells us what time it is and tells you and tells us that it's way past time for all of us to be more active than we have been.
Finally, I wanted to switch to culture and media. I know that you want to talk about the movie Get Out, and it's still on everyone's tongues, even though it's been out for a few weeks now. And even though there have been other kind of blockbusters, you know, coming out in theater since then, it's still a conversation piece. So what were your thoughts when you saw Get Out?
Well, first of all, unlike these other blockbusters, this movie cost less than $5 million. Thus far, it's grossed about $133 million, making Jordan Peele, the young black American writer and director, perhaps the only black filmmaker who, in his debut filmmaking effort, has managed to create a $100 million movie, which is quite remarkable. But on a political level, I see this movie, which, by the way, is a kind of social thriller, a kind of science fiction horror story about an interracial relationship. I see it in the context of other movies that have come out about interracial relationships. I'm thinking of Loving, about the Loving versus Virginia case out of 1960s Virginia, leading to the Supreme Court case saying that interracial marriage can no longer be outlawed. I'm thinking of United Kingdom by Ama Asante, which tells the story of a future leader of Southern Africa who marries a young woman from London in the late 1940s, and the uproar that causes, particularly with the apartheid authorities. These latter two movies present the usual sort of liberal interpretation, and in the conservative era of Trump, I don't find that to be particularly disturbing. But what's interesting about Get Out is that it's an all-out assault, an all-out attack on liberal mythology. And in light of the fact that the liberals have not been carrying their weight of late. They have not been able to give us an interpretation of the Trump phenomenon. They have really bungled electoral politics in this country because, as you said, rather than concentrating on black voter suppression, they're going down the rabbit hole of Russian hacking in terms of trying to explain the Trump victory. And so I think that this movie is a major political statement, and those streaming into the theaters to see it are similarly making a statement about their upset, if not disgust, with the liberal mythology, which has been reigning in this country for much too long.
All right. Well, we'll definitely keep a watch on what's in the theaters. And after we finish talking about politics, some weeks we can go back to the movies and talk some more. Now we're going to actually play a little later in the show a tribute to Mari Evans, and who joined the Ancestors this month. And her funeral was held this week in Indianapolis. You know, hundreds of people came out, including Sonia Sanchez and Haki Madhubuti, to offer their words and performance. So I know that you're familiar with her work. Did you have any thoughts to offer on Mari Evans?
Well, yes, Mari Evans was a soldier in the Black Arts Movement. She was a close comrade of the late Gwendolyn Brooks, a leading daughter of Black Chicago, one of the few black women who's won a Pulitzer Prize. And, of course, Mari Evans is from neighboring Indiana. She passed away at the age of 97. It doesn't surprise me that literary lights like Haki Madhubuti and Sonia Sanchez would show up at her funeral, because she was on that eminent and stellar level. Her poetry still repays attention. It still bears reading and hearing, and certainly she will be sorely missed.
Well, I've been speaking with author and activist Professor Gerald Horn, whose most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want all my people around me. Everybody living good. Everybody eating good. Everybody should. I want all my people around me. Everybody eating good.
Smiling, no need for fear. The kids are learning what they should learn. Finally, folks are earning what they should earn.
I want all my people around me. Everybody living good. Everybody eating good. Everybody should. I want all my people around.
That was Kindred Family Soul, and the music on our first break was Navasha Deya, It's All About Freedom. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio. I'm Esther Averam. Today we are continuing to recognize Women's History Month, and now we're going to hear an interview by Lydia Curtis with Willa Mae Taylor Richmond, who was only 13 years old when she became a foot soldier in the historic 1965 March for Voting Rights, which became known as Bloody Sunday, when peaceful protesters in Selma, Alabama, were viciously attacked by police.
I'm a foot soldier in Selma, Alabama. My name is Willa Mae Taylor Richmond. I normally go by Mae Taylor Richmond. Richmond is the married name. Was a child in the Civil Rights Movement, about 13 during the Bloody Sunday, and lived in Selma, born and raised, all of my life a native. While here, we witnessed entering the bus, paying our money the same as the Caucasian community, but we had to take a seat in the back. Did not have a choice as to where we wanted to sit. We had a beautiful movie theater here, but did not have a choice as to where we wanted to sit. The Caucasian community sat on the lower level. We had to go upstairs to the higher level, which the seats were better there. However, we didn't have a choice. We had to go where they chose for us to go. I witnessed the bathroom signs, colored bathroom signs, colored water fountains. In our school system, there were books that were given to us, but they were secondhand books. Books had been given to the Caucasian schools, and they used them for two or three years, and then the pages and what have you were torn or written in, and they were passed on to us. We learned this because there was a large Jewish community in Selma, and that Jewish community enlightened us on the lesser systems of education that we were in, how we were being degraded and things of that nature. There was also a hospital here, Good Samaritan Hospital, which was really basically known as the Colored People Hospital at that particular time. And it was founded and basically ran by the Jewish community. Many of our African-American brothers and sisters were trained in the medical profession, and that's where they worked and took care of us. My involvement in wanting to see change in Selma was because I saw the racism. I saw the discrimination. My mother worked on base as a cook. My father worked at one of the local grocery stores. And they were looked down upon. But they taught us to look. And my grandmother, who lived to be 100 years of age, she and my grandfather taught us that we could be anything in life that we wanted to be, and we could be the best. My grandparents did not want us picking cotton for the Caucasian farms. At that particular time, people were picking cotton for 50 cents a day. And my grandparents struggled and worked hard and bought their own property over 100 acres of land. And that's where we worked to help to pay for that property for my grandparents, William and Molly Blackmore, in the Lowndes County community, which is about one county over from Dallas. We as children got involved in the movement because the movement had kind of come to a halt. Reason being, many of the adults in Selma worked either for the school system, city or county, or they worked for a county position or a city position. And they were told that if you participate in the movement, that you could lose your home, your cars, any other things that they had accumulated in life. Many of our people had just come off of plantations. Some were still living on plantations. So for them to have their own property and their own land, they were not willing to give that up. And when the movement came to a halt, Dr. King sent for Reverend James Bevel, who was our Dr. King as children. And then when he came, he trained us as Dr. King was training the adult soldiers to be able to stand for what we believed in, that we had equal rights to life just as the Caucasian community did. And he trained us, and as he trained us, we became involved in the civil rights movement, and the movement was able to continue. That's how we ended up in the Bloody Sunday, because of the killing of Jimmie Lee Jackson. So I have seen change in Selma, but there's still much change to be done. What we want our children to understand is that education is the key out of poverty. They need to learn their history, who they are. They came from greatness. And as we instill that in them, we're wanting them to stop fighting one another, to stand up and to care for one another. I'm concerned about our educational system simply because many of our children are reading on third and fourth grade level, math and science on maybe a sixth grade level. They're graduating from high school. It's not giving them the preparation that they need in order for them to attend universities or colleges or vocational schools. They'd be able to be constructors and builders and engineers and CEOs of their own company. So I'm in a dilemma and a fight and a struggle with the education system here in Dallas County. We do not teach African-American history, and that's one of the entities that I'm really trying to help bring into the school system. So, and Ms. Dunkston, the jewel, one of the jewels of our life, I met her maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, and she was just a jewel of a person, personality, attitude, behavior. She exemplified love when you saw her. She spoke with a very gentle spirit. She didn't see to me if there was something that you were lacking. She didn't see that. She saw the beauty of you as a person. She loved the foot soldiers. She is much like Fire Rose to Ray and Hank. They were not here in 1965, actually, in Selma. So Rose often tell us, like Miss Dunkson did, is that because they were not here physically per se, their spirit was here. And they just admire the people who actually took it upon themselves to participate. The courageous eight. My mom and dad was involved in the civil rights movement, relatives. Miss Dunkson was an organizer. And she was a person who believed in business and doing things decent and in order. And giving you an opportunity to be creative and share your experience to make things better for the Jubilee Board. She set an agenda. She stayed on track with that agenda. She was a time frame person, and she took us through that. She organized the Jubilee and is still organized. We're going to carry it on in her stead, bless her heart, because that's what she would want for us to do. Her husband was a jewel. He allowed her to come and participate with us. This year we fought a battle. Last year we did also. The Jubilee has always been organized to the point that we would include the city of Selma to help us, to help sponsor the Jubilee to carry it on. In 2015, the city of Selma decided they wanted to have their own entity of the Jubilee and not really collaborate with us as they had done in the past. And it created confusion. Now we have new administration. We have a new mayor on board. As Ms. Dunkson had been here, she would have been right in the middle of the fight in trying to get them to not to fight, but to bring a sense of unity and peace amongst the Jubilee. Because it's not just for, like Dr. King, it wasn't just for the African-American community. We were the ones who were oppressed and being targeted, but it was for all people. Be able to come together as one and realize that we're all valuable in the sight of God and that we're all entitled to the same justice. We're all entitled to the same equality of life. And Ms. Dunkson is the type of person, she and her husband would have been right here in the middle of trying to help us bring this sense of unity together. So her spirit resonates with us to say to us that peace, continue in trying to bring unity and peace and love to the situation that we're in. And prayerfully and hopefully that will materialize in the near future.
Would you like to share the song now?
Ooh, Lordy. Well, the part that I wanted to say about her was, let's see. Has anybody here seen my old friend Gladys? Can you tell me where she's gone? She feed a lot of people, but the good, they die young. I looked around and she was gone. Didn't you love the things she stood for? Didn't she try to find the good in you and me so that we can be free? Has anybody here seen my old friend Gladys? Can you tell me where she's gone? She freed a lot of people, but the good, they die young. I looked around and she was gone. I looked around and she was gone.
You have been listening to Willamae Taylor Richmond, who was only 13 years old when she became a foot soldier in the historic 1965 March for Voting Rights, which became known as Bloody Sunday when peaceful protesters in Selma, Alabama were viciously attacked by police. Now, we are ending today's show by honoring author and activist Mari Evans. Evans was a poet, playwright, and children's writer. The writer Kalamu Yasalam wrote about her that she explored the nature of community and the power of language to name and reframe. Her best-known poems include Speak the Truth to the People, To Be Born Black, and I Am a Black Woman.
I am a black woman. The music of my song, some sweet arpeggio of tears, is written in a minor key, and I can be heard humming in the night. Can be heard humming in the night. I saw my mate leap screaming to the sea, and I, with these hands, cupped the life breath from my issue in the canebrake. I lost Nat's swinging body in a rain of tears and heard my son scream all the way from Anzio for peace he never knew. I learned Da Nang and Porkchop Hill in anguish. Now my nostrils know the gas, and these trigger-tired fingers seek the softness in my warrior's beard. I am a black woman, tall as a cypress, strong beyond all definition still, defying place and time and circumstance, assailed, impervious, indestructible. Look on me and be renewed.
Now, this following segment about her life was produced by WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis.
Maury Evans proclaimed, "Who can be born black and not exalt?" It seems as if she has lived her life exalting in her blackness. She is a monumental figure in poetry and education and played roles in shaping women's history, politics, music, and drama. Her books of poetry include Continuum, I Am a Black Woman, A Dark and Splendid Mass, and Night Star. From 1968 to 1973, she worked as a producer, writer, and director of The Black Experience, a pioneering social-political television show that aired on primetime in Indianapolis.
In all of time, it has been our artists, our musicians, our poets, who have also been our prophets.
She is the author of numerous articles and children's books. Her work has been included in hundreds of anthologies and textbooks, including translations into many other languages. Her poetic voice helped define the 1960s Black Arts Movement. My fellow panelists and I were honored to recognize Maury Evans for her extensive and exceptional body of work. This is only the second time in the awards history that a Lifetime Achievement Award has been given.
You've finally seen one person with no cell.
And you don't have a computer.
No computer. I'm thinking about getting a computer, but not thinking too hard.
Do you identify yourself as a philosopher, a poet, a writer?
I'm all of that. I'm a political writer.
For all kinds of politics, or mainly African-American issues? How would you describe your...
I look at the world through a black lens.
You moved here in 1947.
Yes.
What was it like to be a black woman in Indianapolis in 1947?
Very much like what it is today.
Have race relations changed much?
Not much. There's cosmetic change. Of course, everybody smiles at everybody, and before, everybody avoided looking at each other, but now we do all look and we do smile.
Still too segregated?
I wouldn't say too segregated. I would delete the two and just say still two worlds. You'll never get over it being two worlds. It will be two worlds as long as there are discernible differences. In each cultural community, there are differences, there are disparities that are significant. We're always going to have different cultural communities. Nobody can expect to have the differences erased because they're there. When people say, I don't see color, either they're lying or something's the matter with their eyesight. The differences are cultural more than anything else, but they appear because of color. They're cultural, but color helps them jump out at you.
I was a young poet in junior high, high school, and even until my young adulthood. But I was influenced by being around other poets, particularly Mari Evans. I remember her book, I Am a Black Woman. And it was in our home, and she used to come by our house. And she and my grandmother were good friends. They both shared similar personality traits. Very intelligent, very tenacious, very ferocious, vivacious. And they came up in a time where they were marginalized, but they leveraged that in a very special way and directed their rage into political activism, into poetry. And that poetry was able to move a nation. If you're fortunate enough to sit with her, she's a very beautiful woman, but she's very sage-like. And she has a quiet charisma and a dynamism that is magnetic. And she kind of pulls you into her orbit. And after she educates you, enlightens you, chides you, she releases you back into the world to be a better person. And I think that for our generation, she represents what it means to be an American icon. That's why we love her.
I always walk my walk as an individual, not as part of a race, which sounds funny, even to me. From the time I was born, I had no fears about the way I walked my walk. I knew God personally as a little girl, not just because I was born into a Christian family. I just came here with the understanding that there was a power greater than me, that I didn't have to worry about anything.
As an activist, you found another way to channel your politics in the late 60s and early 70s through a TV show called The Black Experience.
Yes, with one cameraman and no background in television, I decided to speak to the black community and to explain to the black community my political perception of what was happening to us as a family nation.
Truth is love and beauty, but hate and hostility are also truth. This is a tribute to the black poet, Langston Hughes.
And that was the direction I took the show. I'd like to be remembered as a quintessential jazz pianist, which I am not. That's an honest answer.
And as a writer, as an influencer, as a philosopher?
If people choose. As a philosopher, if I have said anything or can say anything that anybody finds useful, that's why I write. That should be the only reason any of us write, to put material out that can be useful to other people.
There's never a word out of place in her writing, right? Never a word out of place. You don't have to change anything. You don't have to add an it or a comma or a punctuation. Everything is perfectly written. Miss Evans' work continues as an alarm clock, urging those who have set time to plow through racial, political, social injustice in American society, to seek a higher sense of self. Who can be born black? Who can be born black and not sing the wonder of it? The joy, the challenge, and come together. Who can be born black and not exalt? Mari Evans, thank you.
When I die, I'm sure I will have a big funeral. Curiosity seekers coming to see if I am really dead or just trying to make trouble.
How much does that poem say about who you are?
Everything. Yeah, people are still wondering if I'm just trying to make trouble.
Are you?
Without trouble and troublemakers, where would we be? I'm a black woman. The music of my song, some sweet arpeggio of tears, is written in a minor key and I can be heard humming in the night. I saw my mate leap screaming to the sea and I, with these hands, cupped the life breath from my issue in the canebrake. I lost Nat's swinging body in a rain of tears and heard my son scream all the way from Anzio for peace he never knew. I learned Da Nang and Porkchop Hill in English. Now my nostrils know the gas and these trigger-tired fingers seek the softness in my warrior's beard. I am a black woman, tall as a cypress, strong beyond all definitions, still defying place and time and circumstance, assailed, impervious, indestructible. Look on me and be renewed.
Theolonious Monk would be very happy with that.
You think so?
Yeah.
I wouldn't play it if he was in the house.
You've been listening to author and activist Mari Evans in a documentary about her life produced for WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis, where she lived for most of her life. She was actually born in Ohio, but she joined the Ancestors this month at the age of 97. Other voices in the piece are Representative Andre Carson, Democrat of Indiana, Keisha Tandy, writer Tasha Jones, and the journalist is Bob Williams. Thanks to WFYI for use of that piece. Thanks to our guest, Gerald Horn, earlier in the show. And that will about do it for us today. I want to also thank Lydia Curtis and Chantel James for their reporting. Today, this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows, including last week's speech by Chris Hedges, about which I've heard from many listeners. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Pacifica Radio. A special shout out to our regular listeners outside the DMV at Pacific affiliates in Northern New Mexico, Southern Colorado, Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon, and Fairbanks, Alaska. Thanks everyone for listening. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Averam. Keep raising your voice. Peace. I'm